spacecraft from an asteroid and finally made its way to Earth Sunday when the spacecraft landed in Utah. Scientists plan to study and catalog what they find over the next several years, with plans to distribute samples to other scientists around the world. NASA scientists hope that the sample will help provide important information about Earth's origins. Support this local newscast and this station now by becoming a member at kpft.org. And thanks for tuning in to 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Be sure to join us this afternoon at 3:30 for the Mayoral Forum on KPFT HD2 Houston.
To say oil is a part of life in Texas is an understatement. From the accidental discovery of crude oil in East Texas in 1894, drilling and the boom and bust cycles of growth incumbent with extraction have been a part of Texas culture. Drilling for black gold, Texas tea, oil that is, has reshaped the state's economy, cities, and small towns, and our environment in ways that will have impacts for centuries to come. One of the most pressing of these impacts is the afterlives of oil wells. Just because a well no longer produces oil doesn't mean it isn't producing numerous other chemicals and threats. In addition to leaking toxic gases that just so happen to contribute to climate change, these sites can be local hazards that endanger nearby populations, especially when they form into sinkholes that have, in many places, swallowed entire streets and buildings. Today on Gulf Streams, we're discussing orphan wells, what they are, and what we can do about them. I'm Weston Twardowski, an instructor in Rice's Environmental Studies program and the program manager of the Diluvial Houston Initiative, and you're listening to Gulf Streams on KPFT Houston, where we talk with leading experts and community leaders to better understand the environmental problems and potential solutions facing our community. When an oil well is capped, we imagine it no longer causes environmental risks, but in practice, many wells throughout the state aren't capped or are improperly covered, often because of deterioration or even repurposing of materials from the sites by government agencies, which was especially prevalent during World War II. Part of this problem is historic. We've been drilling for oil for well over a century in Texas, and many wells were run by companies that no longer exist or have even been largely forgotten about as time has gone on. But the lingering impacts on the environment, and especially those who live near these sites, can be severe. Do you have a story or question about orphan wells and old drill sites? Give us a call today at 713-526-5738, extension 2. 713-526-5738, extension 2. Today, we're talking with Amanda Drain, energy reporter at the Houston Chronicle, who just completed a fantastic series of stories on orphan wells across the state. And we're also joined by Paige Powell of Commission Shift, a statewide watchdog organization that's been working hard to raise attention to orphan wells and recently put out a report and toolkit specifically on how to address this issue. Amanda, Paige, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. So I just want to start off with the really basic. There's three kind of terms that we tend to hear around these sites. One I've already used, orphan wells, a broader one, abandoned wells, and last one, the thing that we really should have saved this episode for you know, Halloween a month from now, are zombie wells. And maybe Amanda, could you just explain what these terms actually mean and how they're different and what we're talking about?
Sure. So an orphan well is a well with no known owner. Either the known owner doesn't exist anymore, or it can't be traced to a particular owner, or that oil company has filed for bankruptcy or is dissolved. A zombie well is a well that had, according to records, been plugged at one point, but is leaking and is now no longer adequately plugged, or perhaps was never adequately plugged. And an abandoned well
really encapsulates both of those things, I think.
By the industry terminology, an abandoned well means that a well has been plugged. They plug and abandon a well at the end of its useful life, presumably if everything goes according to plan. And so an abandoned well is a well that has been plugged and abandoned. But we, outside of the industry, might have a different understanding of that word. Because abandoned means to neglect, there's a confusion, I think, between...
A tension between industry lingo and how we would commonly interpret it.
Right.
Yeah. But in these cases, we're talking about wells that potentially have been plugged, but oftentimes either haven't been plugged or properly so, or are now starting to cause new problems because of deterioration. Because as we said,
right,
many of these sites, century old, and so the technology has changed substantially. And so I'm wondering if you both could speak some to the risks of these places. Why are we diving into this topic?
I'd actually like to offer, before we move on from the definition, that there's another sort of, like, we have orphaned and abandoned wells. There's also inactive wells, which are owned by a current operator, but they're not using it and it's not plugged. And oftentimes these wells get unlimited plugging extensions. And so they're not technically abandoned, but they're open and emitting all types of fun stuff, just like an abandoned well would, an orphan well. And then we also have undocumented wells. There have not been immaculate records kept since the dawn of drilling. And so ranchers and folks in West Texas are often finding wells that aren't even in the Railroad Commission's database of orphan and abandoned wells.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, in prepping for this episode, I'm looking around and seeing some articles that are saying, you know, oh, there's 7,000, you know, of these wells in Texas, and seeing other ones that, you know, oh, there's 20,000 of these. And
the number I've seen is 8,500 orphan wells, but over 113,000 inactive wells. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's an order of magnitude difference when you're talking about, is the state really taking care of its liabilities and doing what it's supposed to do?
And before we jump into what the state is doing, which we're absolutely going to dive into. No, that's great. I want to know, though, what are the risks? Why are we talking about this? I mentioned some of the chemical runoff, but, you know, I mean, there's a lot of scary effects tied to these sites. So can you talk some about what these are?
Well, I would say that the biggest takeaway for me when I was looking at this was how little we know about how often these unplugged wells allow chemicals, water waste with chemicals, radiation to leach between the different layers that the seal is supposed to protect, like our aquifers. How often is this stuff leaking? We don't know. There isn't a really good answer to that question. Maybe Paige knows more than I do about.
Yeah, I think the risks for orphan wells in particular, abandoned and deteriorating wells, aging wells across the state, is that as they age and there's no ownership of them, the casing starts breaking down. And so there's absolutely much more opportunity for them to leak, you know, oil and gas, toxic chemicals and other things into the ground, into underground sources of drinking water, contaminate aquifers, contaminate groundwater, which is not just bad for, ecosystems that you know, grow in the soil, but also wildlife and ranch animals and the people who live there and farm and, you know, drink well water, right? I mean, I think that's the biggest thing that I'm really concerned about in my work, is this contamination of sources of drinking water in an era of growing water scarcity. As we look at the climate crisis and, you know, dramatic temperature fluctuations and drought, things like that, contamination of our natural resources is a really big threat. And so I think that's one of the largest concerns that I have around orphan wells.
Absolutely. So I think just to add some hard terms so we have an idea, right? Some of the things that we've seen are sinkholes. So as the water table gets affected, sinkholes start to form. And these can be really massive. They can swallow buildings, they can swallow roads, but they can also then leak all these things up, right? And I think you've done a really great look at Lake Bomer and really explored, you know, there's benzene there, I believe, but there's radioactive isotopes, which you start to see and you go, wait a minute, there's radiation coming out of these sites? I mean, this is, and that's addition to methane, things we might more commonly expect to be leaking, which beyond just smelling really bad for anybody who lives around that place, is also directly contributing to climate change. So there are some really tangible impacts that we can immediately trace to these places.
Right. Lake Bomer is maybe the poster child for how bad a site can get when no one takes responsibility for it. And the Railroad Commission will tell you that it's a water well, it's not our jurisdiction. And that's kind of how it has been allowed to fester, because there's no real jurisdiction for a century-old water well that hasn't been plugged. But if the materials that are populating the lake are from oil field waste, it does raise questions about.
And just since it is the poster child, I mean, can you describe this site to us? I know you've spent time around this area. You know, what does this actually look like up close?
I wished the photos that accompanied the story could be scratch and sniff, because it reeks of rotten eggs. I mean, it hits you in the face when you get out of the car at that site. And the air is salty. It has like you're standing at the edge of the ocean feel, but it's very drying. And the salt was gathering on my hands and my skin. Then the alarm started going off, telling us that the air we were breathing while we were there wasn't safe. It was quite a sight.
Yeah.
Quite an experience. But yeah, the water that's coming out of that well, and you can see it comes out at quite a clip. It's gurgling from below constantly. And according to hydrologists who have tested it, it has methane, hydrogen sulfide, which is poisonous gas, radioactivity. And that's not surprising, because there are normally occurring radionuclides, right? I'm asking Paige. that are trapped inside the rock. So when the oil and gas companies drill for oil, it releases other minerals, radionuclides that were trapped alongside the petroleum and the rock. And so when water is flowing beneath the surface, as it is clearly, it's carrying other things with it, like the radioactivity, and pooling it there in a toxic lake that never existed before man's interference.
Lake Bomer, I think, is really interesting. We like to point to this one, too. It was actually brought up at the last Railroad Commission open meeting a couple weeks ago, and one of the commissioners retorted back that, again, this isn't their jurisdiction. It's a water well, and our position maintains that it was drilled as an oil and gas well. It was then, there was no oil found. It was plugged. It was transferred as a water well, and now it's leaking, like we said, radioactive material from oil and gas operations. And so that falls under the definition of orphan well. It very clearly could be the Railroad Commission's problem if they wanted it to be. But for 20 years, this well has been spewing toxic, deadly fluids and gases. And our commissioners at the state are just sort of passing this hot potato back and forth between TCEQ and Railroad Commission, like they don't know what to do about it. But it just shows a real lack of concern for the health and safety of the people of Texas.
I want to pause you there. I absolutely want to keep digging into this, but I feel like I need to channel my inner boy from Louisiana who moved to Texas a couple of years ago and was very confused by the Railroad Commission being a point of conversation in these oil and gas topics. topics. So can you explain why we're talking about the Railroad Commission
sure.
for this?
Yeah, the Railroad Commission of Texas is the state's oil and gas agency. They don't have anything to do with railroads. The name is a legacy from a time gone by, and the commission has failed to modernize with the needs of transparency. You know, we've had that's one of the things that we started Commission Shift with was a petition to change the name because Texas people deserve to have transparency at the ballot to vote for the Texas Oil and Gas Minerals and Natural Resources Administration, whatever it is, right? We can come up with something that makes more sense than Railroad Commission. So,
and I think that's really important when we're talking about, you know, going to commissioners and meeting with the commission. This isn't like, oh, the Railroad Commission, oh, they just happen to have been, you know, thrust in charge of this project. Mm-hmm. This is what they exist for.
Yeah,
they are the oil and gas regulators for the state.
There's three of them. They're elected. You know, you can vote for a commissioner. I don't think this year, but I think next year's election. You know, and so it's something that people should be aware about. You know, they have a lot of power. What do they say that the Texas oil and gas is like something about 40% of we produce 40% of the nation's energy needs here in Texas. And so they oversee a huge economy.
Yep.
And, you know, unfortunately, they, you know, if we had maybe more upstanding folks in office, we wouldn't see so many problems.
And then you mentioned another organization, TCEQ, and I'm wondering if you can just tell us what their role in all this is and define that for us.
So that's the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, and these are two different sort of arms of our state government that have jurisdiction over different things. The Railroad Commission does mining, oil and gas, and pipelines, soon to be, you know, hydrogen and maybe geothermal, which sort of crosses into different things because the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality does groundwater quality, water quality, air quality, and then there's the Public Utilities Commission, which sort of overlaps Railroad Commission a little bit in the transmission of natural gas and different things. So we have these sort of like three agencies at the state level that are, you know, nobody's really sure. I mean, there's some confusion as to who's in charge of what and what makes sense. So,
which is really important because it gets to a broader problem. I mean, this is absolutely a Texas problem. It's also a national problem. It's also an international problem. And who, you know, necessarily is in charge of these different places and needs to act on it. You know, I remember reading in some of your articles about ranchers who have gone out and plugged these themselves and the expense of that. You know, the average is supposedly $20,000 or something, but that this rancher, you know, spent $23,000 plugging one well and then spent $203,000 trying to plug another one and then had to give up because it was just too cost prohibitive. And so that's, you know, almost a fifth of $1 million that didn't even get the well plugged. And that was after the Railroad Commission had plugged a well on a site for something close to $900,000.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, which also points to the disparity of the expense of this, right? And so when we think of, oh, $20,000 to plug a well, that's not representative of what the range of these problems can look like.
Yeah, that was one of the big takeaways, too, is just the vast differences in cost and how we don't really have a firm number of what it will cost society in general to fix some of these wells. I mean, some of the orphans are quite old, and there are a lot in West Texas where we don't know, there are undocumented wells we don't know about. There are wells that predate modern reporting. There are wells that presumably the steel casing could have been ripped from the ground during World War II because it doesn't appear like there's anything there. We don't know if there was one where they pulled burlap sacks out of, according to one source.
I'm assuming that's not regulation approved.
Maybe at one time.
Point being, we've changed somewhat in how we think about these as well, both in how we plug them, but also part of why we're talking about this is the growing complexity of these sites, right? That it, you know, how deep we would drill for oil in 1910 is not remotely comparable to what we're doing today.
And when the wells are left unplugged for decades, for a century, the structure of the well can deteriorate. Mm. So when they go back in to plug it at this point in 2023, they don't quite know what they're dealing with because the structure could have deteriorated, and they have to fiddle with it to find the bottom of it, and that can be hard depending on what kind of structure has been left behind.
And I imagine that makes it infinitely more complicated.
Right. A drilling rig costs a lot of money, and the more weeks they have to spend finding where the bottom is, the more the dollars add up.
And I think that's something that, you know, both the complexity of with these older sites, when we don't know who's accountable for these things. And at the federal or the state government, and to some extent the federal government today, you know, a lack of accountability as well about which organization is responsible for this. As we were talking about with Lake Beamer, you know, the Railroad Commission has said this is not an oil and gas well, which we contest with, or many people will contest with, well, it was drilled for oil. Just because you didn't find oil doesn't mean it's not an oil well. And then to some extent, what you were talking about, Paige, with the, you know, the water issue. These wells start to form networks of a sort, and they get interrelated. And so when one well starts to have problems, it can directly impact surrounding environments and other wells nearby, especially if you think of wastewater that's often pumped into these wells,
yeah.
And that winds up coming out elsewhere. Do you want to talk about some of this?
Yeah, that's actually kind of the biggest thing and overlap that I see, problems with orphan and abandoned wells and problems with injection wells.
Mm.
My work focuses on carbon capture use and storage, and the use in there really stands for EOR, stands for enhanced oil recovery, and that's where CO2 is pumped into non-performing wells or wells that have already sort of like reached their maximum volume or production volume due to normal operations, and so they start pumping fluids in to produce more hydrocarbons. And so you can put water in there, you can put any number of chemical cocktail, including PFAS forever chemicals, but CO2 is one of the favorites because it's buoyant, it really gets things moving. But it also comes with a nice tax credit for carbon storage, wow. For 45Q. And, you know, part of that, to compound the problem, because there are many in this scenario, is that as things sort of start moving in the subsurface, right, and finding these unplugged wells and avenues for escape, we're not just seeing the leakage of, you know, toxic gases and brine water and all of these other things, but the CO2 is leaving as well. So like any carbon or climate benefit that we would have had through enhanced oil recovery, storage of carbon dioxide is completely lost.
And this is one of the major reasons the federal government is really passionate about this, isn't it? That we have, you know, these tens and tens of thousands of sites that could be leaking, you know, if they're not today, maybe they are tomorrow, that, you know, are a concern for us for a host of environmental reasons, but also because collectively they start to really add up in terms of gas leakage that contributes to climate change. So I see we have a call from TJ. So we'll go over to TJ. Hi, TJ, you're on the air. Tell us your question.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a commercial real estate agent who believes that you have done a good job scaring the public about wells. And I'm hoping that you might talk a bit about the types of wells that we find in the city that are for groundwater monitoring that may be less than 200 feet shallow. And if the public should be concerned about those types of wells having a negative impact, or if it's a benefit to society, and what the cost should be from the state and federal government to go onto private property to monitor these issues.
Thank you.
I can't speak. I don't know what type of wells we're talking about. Wells to monitor groundwater. It doesn't sound like it's in the jurisdiction of the Railroad Commission, since it's maybe not an oil and gas well. Again, that kind of points to the problem, but I can't speak to that question.
TJ, it was. Mm-hmm. I encourage you to email me at amanda.drain, drane, at houstonchronicle.com, and we can chat more about what you're seeing. I mean, when you look at the Railroad Commission's GIS map and you zoom in on Houston, you can see that there are some areas where there were old wells. south of the loop, to the north, northwest of the loop, Conroe area. So just because a well is old doesn't necessarily mean that there are problems. It just means we should all be keeping an eye out.
I would also encourage you, actually, in Amanda's, you know, kind of, she did a series of three different articles all focused on this topic, but also put out a really excellent map of wells around Houston that I glanced at and really kind of sat there thinking, I'm not going to see too much, like, in Houston proper, right? And was a little shocked, actually, at how much was right around us, especially in areas like Spring and Prairie Oaks and Baytown, which Baytown I found, unfortunately, less surprising given the various complex environmental histories around there. But, you know, as we talk about subsidence really becoming a major issue in Spring in that area, you know, I think being aware of the well population there is really key to understanding that conversation. So it's certainly around something that we should be thinking about. And I would absolutely say go check out all of your coverage of the Houston Chronicle, but also check out that great map the Chronicle put out. Amanda, can you give us your email address one more time for TJ?
Sure. It's amanda.drane at houstonchronicle.com.
So I want to dig in a little into the Railroad Commission itself. What is the Railroad Commission doing about this, and should they be doing more? And if so, what should they be doing?
What is the Railroad Commission doing about orphan wells? Well, I think they're actually pretty proud of their orphan well plugging work. They talk about that at the open meetings pretty regularly as we continue to challenge them. I know that there is some movement at the federal level to allocate federal funding for plugging of Lake Beamer, since we don't seem to be coordinated enough to do that our own here in Texas. But the state maintains that they're plugging more wells than the rest of than anywhere else in the country, which is probably true. But we also have an outsized proportion of unplugged wells. And I think, you know, as I pointed to earlier about the inactive well problem, how there's over 100,000 inactive wells that are currently owned by active operators, but they're, you know, been inactive for more than 12 months with untold plugging extensions. Some of these wells have 20 years of plugging extensions, and so they've been sitting there idle for decades, just, you know, emitting all sorts of carcinogens and neurotoxins and, you know, greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So I would say that they're not doing enough.
Yeah, the Railroad Commission is proud of its well plugging program, and I think as far as the states go, it does have one of the more robust well plugging programs. But that is as it should be, because Texas produces the lion's share of the oil in the U.S. I think the question is, are they bringing in enough money through their revenue, the fund that they've created for this purpose? And some would say no. And the industry would tell you that they already pay a lot of money for this fund. You have the federal government kicking in now $5 billion for the purposes of plugging old wells. There's questions being raised about how to bring in more money for this purpose and who should be footing the bill. There's a movement to incorporate carbon credits and to incentivize energy companies that are and well plugging companies to go and plug old wells in exchange for carbon credits. There's people talking about how the Railroad Commission could and should increase the bonds that are associated with these wells so that they have a bigger pool of money to use when a well goes into orphan status and there's no company to plug it.
Well, and something that, I mean, the Railroad Commission understandably wants to, you know, demonstrate their achievements and put forward what's been successful. Famously, they have continued to state there is no systemic issue here. And I'm wondering how much just even a kind of mental frame change, you know, more than 44,000 of these wells the Railroad Commission has been plugging since the 80s. And I think at a certain point, you know, if we're talking about 40 years of doing this, this is, you know, about a thousand wells a year. Like, that's not systemic. This feels like we continue to discover and have new ones that go offline and have to be dealt with. And so it seems like a systemic response would be warranted in some way, which certainly is about funding, but is also just about thinking more largely, I think, about how these are monitored and understood and investigated.
Right. That's just it. If your orphan well list number never goes down because more come online than you plug every year, then you're not really doing the program a service, right? So what does that mean about how do we invest more funding into it? And Amanda, you hit it right on the head around, you know, how do we set up the financing structures for these wells in the first place to prevent orphan wells from happening. There's also sort of like predatory transfer policies that we can prevent, you know, of a well getting transferred to smaller and smaller operators until that operator then goes bankrupt. And now the original, you know, multimillion dollar highly financed operator is long gone. So there are a lot of policy changes that can be put in place to really prevent and phase out the phrase orphan well. I mean, Texas is proud of its oil and gas history, and I think that that's something that we can ride on. We really need to, like, you know, be the sort of leader of the world in energy policy. We have an opportunity right now to do that.